Washington. Lipner did a BSc, not quite a BSc, in Chile. I can't pronounce what the degree really is, so I'll say a BSc. And then he went off, did a PhD at MIT, all the
Thank
in mathematics. Excuse me. And he did a postdoc at the Gross Hilbert Institute in New York City for a while, and then became an assistant professor at MIT, where he was for about 5 years. He's been at the University of Washington in mathematics since 1985, right? And the title of his talk today is The Mathematics of Reflection Seismology. And we didn't order up the earthquake in Seattle, especially for the talk. Not a nice thing to say, but anyway, right. He'll make the reference to it.
Okay. Thank you very much for the invitation. So it's always a pleasure to be in Vancouver, and one of my favorite cities in the world. And also, thank you for changing the day of my talk. Well, actually, reflection seismology is not study of earthquakes. And after what happened last week, I thought that maybe should change fields. It has to do more with finding oil rather than very deep structures in the earth. So the outline of my talk is the following. I'm going to model reflective waves, echoes, and what I'm going to concentrate is to extract the speed singularity. So we're going to model this Earth as an acoustic medium initially, and how to imagine the sound, the singularities of the sound speed. Not the sound speed itself, but its singularities. And the mathematical method I am referring in my title of the talk, and I want to make emphasis on, is microlocal analysis. So I'm going to talk a little bit about microlocal analysis and wave propagation. And the last part, which is more recent work, is about the case of an isotropic medium, where the Earth is considered an anisotropic elastic medium rather than acoustic medium, which is the initial model. Okay, so this is the setup. So this is supposed to be the surface of the Earth. So I have sources or receivers, and initially will be of sound. I will send sound waves down to the Earth. Will be scatters. So the sources will reflect from those scatters, and they will be measured at the receivers. And the inverse problem is to recover these scatters, because that's where the changes in refraction property of the medium occur. I should put this more in the medium. So what's the model? Well, this is not a very realistic model, but that's the initial model I'm going to take. You take an acoustic model of the Earth. So C denotes here the index of refraction of the sound speed underneath. And the source will be indicated by S, like in the picture there, and the receiver by an R. So we are going to put a delta function at the sources. That's the model of the source. We put a delta function, an infinite impulse there. And we solve the wave equation. P denotes the pressure at time, at position x and time t. We assume that the pressure is zero for large enough negative time, say for time less than zero. In the sub, what we want to study is this map, the nonlinear scattering operator, which maps the sound speed to the pressure measured at source receivers for a finite amount of time, for time between zero and capital T. So so we measure here the pressure at the receivers. Okay? So we, of course, we noted it as the sources. And we would like to recover from those measurements C, the sound speed below. So there are different cases of acquisition geometry that are considered. Let me just point out some here. Here you have one source and three receivers, or three sources, three receivers, and you, what you want to look at is the reflections from the cathode. And from those, you would like to recover those scatters, I repeat, once more. Okay. Well, this problem is extremely difficult, this nonlinear map, to and in fact, very little is known about this problem, except in the case that C depends only on one variable. If it is a one-dimensional problem, it's a layer medium, things like that, then a lot is known about this problem. But in the general case, for a general sound speed, inhomogeneous sound speed, it's not even known whether you can recover uniquely the sound speed. Even the uniqueness, the sort of basic question, whether you can determine C, is not known at all. So what is done is to linearize the problem. And consider the following model. You take a smooth background. So this is the migration problem. Take a smooth background and you perturb it by a very singular perturbation. This will be, has jumps, for instance. Delta C will be a distribution. It has jumps. And then the pressure is changed by the pressure determined by C0 plus a perturbation delta P. And this is the scale separation, is a model which has not been justified mathematically. However, it's used in practice. That you consider the map, mapping the delta C, which is, remember, has jumps. It's a distribution now, to the perturbation produced by this delta C at the surface of the earth, as sources and receivers in the earth. So we linearize formally the problem, and the linearized problem, this is the equation that satisfied. Box zero means the wave equation or the sound speed, the background sound speed, and it satisfies an inhomogeneous equation of this form. Remember, this C0 is supposed to be positive. This is the solution of the wave equation that we had previously with the background C0. And delta C is on the right-hand side of the equation. So delta C, which is a singular perturbation, is acting as a source. Okay, so these discontinuities on the right-hand side, these forcing discontinuities will produce discontinuities on delta P, and from measuring those, we would like to recover delta C, the perturbation. So this is the scale separation that we are using between a smooth background and a singular perturbation. It's a model that has to be justified, but it seems to work. So the linear inverse problem is, for a known background sound speed, estimate the perturbation so that this map, the linearized map, delta F, delta C, gives you delta P at where you are measuring it. So you make the measurements at the boundary, and you would like to recover delta C. So in other words, we want to invert this operator delta F in some ways. And what this approximation sign means, we're going to look at the singularities, because that's what you would like to determine, the singularities of the perturbation, not the perturbation itself. So we're going to recover the singularities of delta C. So approximately means just the main singularities. Okay. So, are you following? So he's my guide about. Well, this is. Sorry. Okay. I'm blocking the view. Okay. So let me give an integral representation for this operator delta f that we define here, which maps, it's too long, delta c to the measurements, the variation of the measurements, the pressure at the boundary. And this is just a formal derivation, this delta p, of course, with a delta function at x equal to the receiver and time equal to t prime. Just formally, this is what it is. But this is the wave equation at p0 is given by this. That's by definition. So you integrate by parts using Green's theorem. Again, all of this is formal calculation that can be justified. And what we get, the delta p measured at source, receiver, and time is given by this integral representation, so which involves the background sound speed, the solution of the wave equation with the background c0, the background pressure, and delta c that you would like to determine. So you want to invert this operator, this from delta, this integral equation, recover delta C from delta P. That's our goal. So let me tell you what the approaches are. There is an approach due to Belkin, which uses geometrical optic expansions, but that only works in the presence, in the absence of caustics. We'll explain this a little bit more. And there have been new developments in the last 30 years or so in mathematics, where you can have expansions that work when there are caustics present. And that's the theory of Fourier integral operators and Michael-Locke analysis, and that's what I want to explain, that will allow you to recover delta C from delta P. So let me give you a picture of a caustic. Caustic are envelopes of rays. The rays that I was describing before, these rays that I draw in the initial picture, which are here, which we have to really define. These are the rays, which are perpendicular to the wavefront and their reflection. Those rays can form envelopes like this. Those are caustics. Yeah. And the geometrical optic expansion that we are going to discuss a little bit later does not work when you have these envelopes of rays or rays intersecting, things like that. But the main thing that we are going to use about caustics is that every ray has a different direction. You can distinguish the rays in a caustic by its direction. Okay, this is a familiar concept in classical mechanics. You go to phase space and you look at points and directions rather than just the rays themselves. So what we're going to do is lift our analysis to phase space, x cross R3. So we are going to add all the possible frequencies. In mathematical terms, this is called the cotangent bundle of X. That's just a name. So, but these are the covectors, position and direction. And the point, although this has a very complicated structure, the caustic, the structure of the phase is extremely complicated. Upstairs, if you look at phase space in the space of points and directions, this set forms a nice manifold. It has a nice structure. And in fact, it's what's called, I will talk a little bit but later, is the Lagrangian manifold. So that's one of the main points of what I'm going to talk about. So let me summarize And I'm going to explain this in a little bit more detail in a moment. Let me see. Up here. How are we going to invert this operator? There are two approaches. One is called a Fourier integral operator, and this was done by Rakesh in 88, which you write delta F delta C. This is the operator, this operator. Remember, this is the operator delta F delta C as a Fourier integral operator. So what's the main point? The main point, it has an amplitude and a phase, e to the I phi, but the phase depends on direction, your average, not only on position, but also on direction. Go back here. The news. Remember in the picture I had before of a caustic, there are different directions. So what we're going to do is average in the space of directions as well. So for every direction, we have a different phase. And then we're going to average those. That's called a Fourier integral operator, and I decided last night to actually add a little bit more about these aspects, otherwise for the people who don't know. In the standard geometrical optic approximation, which is away from these caustic points, away from when there are envelopes of rays or focusing of rays, the standard geometrical optic approximation consists of an amplitude and the delta function, and this is a phase called the travel time from S to X. So tau of X of Y is the travel time that takes a ray from God to X to Y. Yeah, but this approximation is only valid as long as travel times are defined. And travel times are not defined in the presence of caustics, like I had there. And this will lead to the following approximation, an amplitude times second derivative of T minus tau. This is source, position, receiver, source. So it's a generalized Radon transform in the following sense, that you are integrating, this is a delta function, second derivative over the surface where T is equal to tau plus tau. You're integrating over certain surfaces. The standard Radon transform is integrating over planes. And you want to invert that Radon transform. And that was done by Belkin in 85. And I will explain how to invert that transform. But the main gain here in this over this is that this is valid in the presence of caustics. So a little bit of microlocal analysis. I'm sorry for the people who know about this, but this is I want to explain a little bit more what does microlocal analysis consist of. Suppose you take a distribution, and you can think as a function having jumps. This is the type of discontinuities that we would like to determine. This is the notation for distribution. We define the notion of wavefront set of a distribution. That lives in phase space and the space of positions and directions. Remember, we're going to add directions. So instead of mu, I'm going to call my direction C from now on. So a point in a direction is not in the wavefront set if only if the Fourier transform, when you cut off u near x, is rapidly decreasing function. So it tells you when the Fourier for what directions the Fourier transform is not rapidly decreasing. If you are in the wavefront set, it's not rapidly decreasing. So it localizes in phase space, as we're going to see in a moment. And if you take the projection into from phase space to x, you recover the singularities of the function u. So this is much more general concept, the wavefront set. it lives in phase space, and if you project, you recover the singularities of you. And it's an extremely useful concept. So let me explain, give you some examples. For instance, take the delta distribution, an infinite impulse at zero. What's the wavefront set of that distribution? The wavefront set is everything, because the Fourier transform of delta zero is one. It doesn't decay in any direction. This determines the direction of not decay. The wavefront set is not decay, and if you are not in the wavefront set, decay. The Fourier transform doesn't decay in any direction. So the wavefront set are the point zero, of course, because you have a singularity at zero in every possible direction. However, take the wavefront set of the delta function of the line x1 equal to zero in two dimensions. Okay, that's defined by integrating over the line x1 equal to zero. The wavefront set of that is, of course, x1 equal to zero, x2, and then c1 equal to zero, and this direction c2 must be zero. And this direction, I will explain this a little bit in a moment, this direction is normal to that plane. The direction is normal to the plane. And why is that? The reason is that if you are traveling on the plane, on the line x1 equal to zero, this is the delta function x1 equal to zero, you don't see any singularity. You only see singularity when you approach in the normal direction. Of course, every direction has a tangential component and a normal component. Only the normal one is the strongest one that you see. So that's why the wavefront set of this is in the normal direction. So you see, it depends on the properties of the Fourier transform, decay properties of the Fourier transform, and you can localize in phase space using this concept of wavefront set. It was a conceptual breakthrough, and this is was due to Hormander. Okay, so I have to explain certain things in order to give an idea of the kind of things that we are going to do. So you take an operator. Remember, we're going to analyze operators. That's why I talk about operators. Delta F is an integral operator. It has a kernel. And the wavefront set of K of U, this is just a result, is contained in the wavefront set of this kernel here. And there is a little prime. This is just a technical thing composed with the wavefront set of U. This tells you how the singularities of this are related to the singularities of this and the singularities of that. So it's a composition. Okay, so if this has a singularity and this has a singularity, produces a singularity here, as you expect. The wavefront set prime, you have just to change the sign in the last component. So X is the domain, Y is the range, and you just change the sign. This is a technical reason. So this tells you, the wavefront set of the kernel tells you how singularities are propagating, how singularities are spreading. You want to spread the singularities of U by the singularities of this K. Okay? Yes? This is a infinity. This is a concept for infinity singularity. Okay? With a distribution which is not smooth. But there is also the concept of different kinds of singularity. For instance, you can be that the Fourier transform doesn't decay rapidly but decays to certain order. There is also that kind of concept. This is the stream. Okay? It's infinity singularity. It decays rapidly to all orders. Okay? So there are some operators, Goldschmidt differential operators, that don't spread singularities. These are operators of this form, which you can also write it in this with this type of phase functions. And the wavefront set of the kernel that we're talking about here is the diagonal, XXCC. So XXCC, so that means that it's not spreading at all of singularities. The wavefront set of AU is containing the wavefront set of U. So those two differential operators don't express singularities at all. That's very important. Examples of two differential operators, of course, are differential operators, like the Laplacian. You can write in terms of the Fourier transform this way. But another more important one that will come up later is the square root of the Laplacian, which is not a differential operator, where this amplitude is modulo of C. Is the square root of C squared, modulo of C. So these type of operators don't spread singularities, so differential operators. Then maybe I shouldn't have gotten involved in trying to give a crash course on macro-local analysis. I don't know. I was doubting about this. I did it at the last minute. Okay, there are Fourier integral operators. So the claim was that the scattering operator was a Fourier integral operator, as I indicated before. They have a phase function and an amplitude. And examples are solutions of the wave equation. Take the initial value problem for the wave equation, and this is the solution. You can write it explicitly by taking Fourier transform. And the wavefront set of Fourier integral operators, this is spreading, determined by the phase function, and this is determined by this lambda phi, which I write here is x, y. You take the differential with respect to x of the phase function, I should do it here. The differential with respect to y of the phase function, where the c differential is zero. Now this is just a thought, I don't have time to explain that. But the main point is for Fourier integral operators in general, there is spreading of singularities by this lambda phi that depends on the phase function. That determines how singularities are going to spread. I can see from the faces here that I may be boring some people here, but very quickly, let me just mention, what's the point of this that I talk about later, that this is determines the spreading of the singularity. It's always a Lagrangian manifold in phase space. Remember, these are points and directions. What is a Lagrangian manifold? A Lagrangian manifold, say, in R6, XY, in R6, C eta, which is the physical case, has dimension 6, has half of the dimension of the whole space, and there is some form called the symplectic form, which I wrote here, vanishes there. So these are very special manifolds upstairs. Remember the point. Why are those important? Because for the case of a caustic, the picture I drew before, for the set of rays, the points and directions form a Lagrangian manifold. That's the So that's, there's one more thing that's here. This is the Hamiltonian vector field. This is the principal symbol of the wave equation. You replace ddt by tau squared and ddx by c. This is the principal symbol. You're looking at phase space again, the wave equation. The Hamiltonian vector field defined by Hamilton is this vector field in phase space. And the integral curves of this vector field are called by characteristic curves. So you just solve dxi ds is equal to this, dc di is equal to minus dp dxi. This is a vector field in space defined by this function p, which is the principal symbol of the wave operator, or the directions of the normals of the wave equation. All of this is to be able to make analysis in phase space. Whole point. Okay, what is the standard geometrical optical approximation? This might be more well known. You take the wave equation, and you solve the wave equation by an amplitude tensor delta function was t is equal to phi of x. Phi equal to constant are the fronts, the wave fronts. Phi measures the travel time from one front to the other. And this is the amplitude. First of all, the phase satisfies the Connell equation. It's a non-linear first-order equation. Gradient phi squared is equal to 1 over c squared. This is, you just plug in into here and look for the highest order singularity, and it has to cancel. But there are only local solutions. That's the main point. This phase function is only defined locally because this is a non-linear equation and blows up when you have caustics, when you have rays coming in together. There are no more global solutions. And the transport equation for the amplitude is simply this ordinary differential equation, dVA plus 1/2 A times the Laplacian phi equal to 0. Of course, all of these, the two equations, the transport equation and the Connell equation, blow up at caustics, because these rays, these are the rays perpendicular to the wave fronts, they have envelopes, so they come together. You cannot solve this ODE or this nonlinear PDE at those points. So that's the advantage of the microlocal analysis point of view, that you don't have to look at the phase function. So let me come back to this point once more. The point is the following, that come back to this vector field here. Is that Lagrangian manifolds can be obtained by flowing out from sigma, by flowing out by bicharacteristic curves. Remember, bicharacteristic curves were the integral curves of this vector field, the Hamiltonian vector field. The rays, by the way, are just the rays that I defined previously are just the projections into X. But looking at phase space gives you the flow out, so you take the Hamiltonian vector first, transversal to sigma to some initial surface, and this forms a Lagrangian sun manifold always. So that's the point. Upstairs, the set of rays has very nice behavior, because for every point you have and the direction, you have a unique bicharacteristic. However, down in X, at caustics, there are many, many rays that come together. So let me summarize the main point. Instead of looking at the phase function at the travel time phi, like we did before, in the standard geometrical optics approximation, this phi, we look at the Lagrangian manifold. And instead of rays, we consider bicharacteristic curves. That's the analysis in phase space. I think I'm doing okay on time. Okay, so what we did before, this is sort of ends my crash course on microlocal analysis. And we have this operator coming back to the problem that we want to solve. In the case of non-caustics, we have to invert this operator, which is a generalized Radon transform. It's a second derivative. You're integrating over these surfaces where t is equal to tau of sx plus tau of xr. These are the travel times. In the Fourier integral operator case, you have to invert that operator. So how to invert generalized Radon transform? Let me first take this case, which is the easiest case. The following. Let me just remind you of some very old result of Radon. Suppose you integrate, instead of a surface, you integrate along a line. this direction with normal, my normal here is not really normal, doesn't look normal to the line, it should be small like this. And with distance modulo of S to the origin, and the transpose operator, you take a point X and consider all the lines going through this point, that's denoted by X omega, and you average over all possible directions. That's the transpose of the random transform. So what's done is you take your random transform, it's called back projection, you back project with the random transpose, and that operator is an elliptic pseudo-differential operator that can be inverted on the nose with the square root of the Laplacian. And this is the formula that is used in X-ray tomography. When you want to recover the density from the integration along lines, this is exactly the formula that's used, and this is a pseudo-differential operator preserves singularities. Remember, pseudo-differential operators don't express singularities. So this idea, very simple idea that is from the 20th century, 17 something, is the one that actually solves that problem there, because one can prove that F transform F, remember F is the operator that we want to invert, F transform F is an elliptic pseudo-differential operator. This is similar to R transpose R in this case. You back project by taking the transpose of the operator, and this doesn't express singularities. And in fact, you can invert it by some operator A, which is not the square root of the Laplacian anymore, plus an operator which is called smoothing, because this operator applied to any distribution is smooth. So this operator K is negligible in terms of singularities. Every distribution maps it to something smooth. So you can recover, if you know F applied to something, in our case was F of delta C, you can recover delta C modulo smoothing. You can recover the singularities of delta C from F applied to delta C. And that's the procedure to invert. And this procedure is actually used in practice. So that's the case of non-caustics. But however, caustics are always present in the subsurface of the Earth. In fact, there is a paper by Brian White called The Stochastic Causes. That's almost everywhere there is a caustic. Because rays, you know, there is a very heterogeneous behavior on the subsurface of the Earth, and rays tend to form envelopes and cross and so on. It's very unnatural to assume that there are no caustics. So what we can prove using more sophisticated methods of microlocal analysis, and those I'm not going to go to describe here at all, that F transform F is not anymore a pseudo-differential operator, but it's called a singular pseudo-differential operator. You can see my handwriting got really... It says here that can be inverted. This operator can be inverted modulo smoothing still. But that involves much more microlocal work, but the essential procedure is the same. This is a more complicated operator that can express singularities, but the spreading, the singularities that spread are weaker than the main singularity. So you still can invert this operator. And there has been some earlier work done about this from Nolan, Smith, and Al, Stock, several other people, because you want to understand what's called a normal operator, what kind of operator it is, and invert it. Because Well, my hope is maybe some of you will try to do this numerically, but I don't know how to do that. Okay, so I'm running out of time, so I think I will skip some of the... Well, maybe I will talk a little bit about the case of Fourier operators, just mention very briefly the Lagrangian manifold associated to the Fourier operator F, this operator F. So here we are at the surface of the S, it's two-dimensional. These are the directions. Maybe one switches the sign of one of them. So you take a bi-characteristic coming with that direction, coming from there, and it hits. This comes from the source, and it hits a bi-characteristic coming from the receiver in some other direction. This is with certain time t incidence, and this is the difference between t minus t incidence. T is the travel time of this broken by characteristic from source to receiver. Okay? And here, this direction C is such as the angle of incidence is equal to angle of refraction, so Snell's law is valid. So that's the path. And this is, as I said before, the main point is this is a nice submanifold up in phase space. If you project this down to phase space, to the actual space, then you get these costets. Okay, I hope I have convinced you, that looking at phase space is much better than looking at the situation in for rays. And now I want to go to the second part of my talk, which is to describe what happens when you consider a much more complicated model of the Earth. The Earth is not an acoustic fluid. The model was solving the wave equation with certain index of refraction, and that's very that's not true. The Earth is more like we've seen in earthquakes, it's more like an elastic medium. And even more so, it behaves like an anisotropic elastic medium. Why is it anisotropic? That means the elastic parameters depend on direction. It's because the mantle, for instance, of the Earth has crystals, certain crystals called oblivine, and those crystals are very anisotropic. They behave very different directions. The reason why the elastic model has not been considered because it's quite complicated, but I want to attack that case as well. So let me consider this more realistic model, and as I said before, it's an anisotropic effect. It's weakly anisotropic. The anisotropies are small, but still important effects for wave propagation. There are many different types of waves that appear when you consider an anisotropic wave. For the people who know, it's quasi-shear waves, quasi-compressionable waves, and even the quasi-shear, there's a splitting when you go from isotropic to anisotropic of a shear wave into quasi-shear horizontal and vertical. Very complicated behavior of elastic waves. So let me very quickly over the model. So what's attraction? That's something I want to define first. So is the change of force by unit area. Let's define here. The traction is a tensor times the normal, and it's called a stress tensor, TIJ. And what is the equation? So you have an F, which is the body force density. So by just the divergence theorem, you have the divergence of the stress plus the F is equal to the source. The displacement is D. And related to displacement, you define the linear strain tensor. Here there is an approximation. This is actually non-linear, but we take the linear elasticity equations, which is the gradient of the displacement. This is the derivative with respect to xj plus the derivative with respect to xi of the jth component of the displacement. Now you have a system of equations. Okay? So d has components di, and this is the derivative with respect to xj and the derivative with respect to xi. So this is a symmetric gradient, gradient u plus gradient of u transpose. Gradient d, sorry, d is a displacement. Stress tensor and the strain tensors are related, and this is Hooke's law, by the elastic tensor. This is has four indices, and by Newton's law, F is mass times acceleration, this is the equation that we get for the displacement. Much more complicated system of equations for the displacement. Let me mention that in three dimensions, this tensor, the elastic tensor, has some symmetries. And in three dimensions, by the way, rho is the density, you have 21 independent components. So we're going to try to recover 21 elastic parameters of the subsurface of the earth, measure it on the boundary, and measuring the response to reflections. And now, as I said before, the wave propagation is much more complicated. Okay. So again, I'm not going to repeat this. We consider a linearized problem. The perturbation of the displacement satisfy this equation, and this is the source term now. This knows the background elastic tensor. We're going to perturb the elastic tensor by perturbation, and this perturbation will be singular. This is the scale separation. And actually, in this case, I'm even going to consider a variation of the density. So the linearized maps to the perturbation of the displacement at sources and receivers. And these are sources and receivers, and I'm assuming that these are open subsets on the boundary as before. So the inverse problem is to recover these parameters knowing this information on the boundary. This is what I just said. Given this at the surface of the Earth for a finite amount of time, find the elastic parameter. And what we want to find is the singularities of the perturbation. Again, this is a method only to recover singularities. Okay. So let me tell you why is this a very complicated problem as compared to the acoustic case. The linear elasticity equations have double characteristics. Would I talk about the principal symbol or the direction of normals? I'm going to give you a picture. Intersect, the wave speeds coalesce. In the case of the wave equation, you have just one sound speed, C. Here, at one point, there are wave speeds that can have the same. That has double characteristics, it's called. And the solution of this scattering operator is very complicated in the neighborhood of the double characteristic points. So the problem is to show what are the contributions coming from this double characteristic point. And actually, we're going to show, and this is the main point of the analysis, is that you can neglect the contributions from the double characteristic points. You can neglect them, invert away from those points, and apply the analysis that we did previously. The analysis away from the double characteristic points is very similar to the analysis that we did for the acoustic case. Although it's a little bit complicated, of course. So let me tell you the complication for a simpler elastic medium. And I took this from some lecture notes of Burridge at the Stanford Summer School in Geophysics, Mathematical Geophysics. This is the elastic tensor when you have cubic symmetry. It's a very particular case, and you can see the intersection of the different surfaces, the different sheets. And at the intersection, something very peculiar is happening. You have conic type singularities. This is the Sloane's surface. I call it the characteristic variety. And you have conic singularities there. The sheets intersect, forming a cone. Okay, so the question is the analysis: what happens near this intersection of the different sheets? And there is a phenomenon very similar. It's not for an elastic medium, it's for an electromagnetic medium with double characteristics called conical refraction, which was discovered by Hamilton in 1831. So let me quickly, because it's a very important motivating example. And instead of looking at the elasticity equations, I'm going to look at the simpler system. Believe it or not, elasticity is much more complicated than Maxwell equations. And I'm going to look at Maxwell equations in anisotropic crystals. So this is the electric displacement, the magnetic displacement. This is constant, the sound speed, the speed of light, cool of H, cool of E, the standard. The electric displacement now in the anisotropic case is not in the same direction as electric field. And I'm going to assume there is no magnetic material, so this is just a scalar. So it's the same direction as the magnetic field. That's the same. And we have these two conditions. Anisotropic and biaxial crystals, that the three eigenvalues of the dielectric dielectric constants are different. The three eigenvalues are different. And mu. So this is propagation in crystals. For instance, aragonite is a biaxial crystal. And this system has also the same phenomenon that this has. I'm talking about this one because it's easier to analyze. So the characteristic variety has conic singularities. A little time left. Let me give you a simpler example of conic singularities. Take the wave equation. You are in three space dimensions, but take the wave equation in less dimensions. So they also, if you take the standard wave equation, there will be C3 squared here. And look at the zeros of that. That has a cone singularity. That's, I'm just giving you a simpler example of the situation that happens for elasticity. Of course, this is a hookup model. It's just to have an example. When C3 is equal to 1, you have a conic singularity there. Okay, this is one of the few cases that mathematicians have been ahead of the physicists, in the sense that Hamilton, just by purely theoretical consideration, predicted conical refraction, and he didn't have Maxwell equations. That's even the most impressive thing. Predicted conical refraction, which is the following phenomenon, that if a ray will come in the direction of the optic axis, it will split. Here is the face of the crystal. It will split and form a ring of light. If you are away from the optic axis, the ray splits into two. That's called double refraction. But he predicted in the optic axis are the directions where you have double characteristic points. So it'll be this direction, 0, 0, 0, 1, for instance. So you should see a ring of light when you shoot a ray in the direction of the optic axis. That was predicted by Hamilton and actually comproved experimentally 1 year later. However, when the experiments became more precise, this is the pictures that they found. I'm taking this from Born and Wolf, Principles of Optics. It says here, light distribution arising from conical refraction. You can actually see two rings of light separated by a darker ring. And what is the explanation for this? And the explanation can actually be done in terms of microlocal analysis, is that the darkened ring in the middle, you can never shoot a ray exactly in the direction of the optic axis. That's impossible in practice. So you will have to shoot a beam of light. The darker ring in the middle is in fact the contributions coming from the optic axis. So the dark ring is what Hamilton said that you should see, but in fact you don't see it. The contributions coming from here come from the single characteristic point, from all the, remember there will be a beam, a solid beam. You cannot have just rays. And those produce the two other rings. This is a rubber ring phenomenon, and that can be understood again using microlocal analysis. So the point is that the contribution from the double characteristic points are weaker than the contributions coming from the simple characteristic points. And that's what's happening for elasticity as well. And it's not easy to prove, and we are just... So this is a joint work with Cliff Nolan. We prove that this scattering operator is not a Fourier operator as in the case of acoustics, but the wavefront set, remember this is the spreading of singularities, is similar to the acoustic case, this scattering relation that I showed you later, although this is more complicated because you have all these possible waves of propagation, polarization, etc. But you have something else. But the something else is weaker. The singularities there are weaker. Like here, the contribution from the double characteristic points are weaker than the contributions coming from the simple characteristic points, the points when the sound speed don't coalesce. And still, you can invert this operator. Okay, that involves quite complicated analysis, which I'm not going to describe. And we're trying, actually Cliff's trying, because I don't know how to do these calculations, to implement this for a transversely isotropic material. Transversely isotropic material, you have special symmetries, you only have 5 elastic parameters instead of 21. Transversely isotropic occurs for fine layering of medium, behaves like isotropic in some directions. You only have 5 parameters, so it should be much easier problem, and he tells me that this looks very good. So let me finish. The conclusion of the second part of my talk, which is the new part, so away from the double characteristic is possible to build experiments to invert for general isotropic elastic materials. I should say the numerical method is only, we have a theoretical result that the numerical method is only for transversely isotropic. But this is the main point of the analysis, that the double characteristic scattering was less singular than the simple characteristic scattering. The points where the sound speeds coalesce, as I showed you in this picture, contribute weaker singularities than the remaining ones. So therefore, we can recover the principal singularities even for anisotropic elastic material. Okay, so that's the end of my talk. Thank you. That's completely incomprehensible.
Direction with something like a ray, right?
Right.
So and all this small cutting around, you can consider that as a scattering event. So is there a connection with the Boltzmann equation?
Yeah, I don't know. We can talk about this. But what you can do when the phase space fills up, I mean, even the ray, even the characteristics are not good. You can go one
step up. I'm not going to describe second grade, and look at the rays of the rays there, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
How do you determine that? All of these experiments that's done, you use an homogeneous approximation.
So can you quantify somehow how it could have approximation to be?
That's the problem in the, as I mentioned before, this linearization, this scale separation assumption has not been justified in any way. I mean, how smooth has to be the C0, for instance? How singular has to be the delta C comparatively? There's no indication of. The only good thing about this is it seems to work. So there must be a theorem behind. But that's, you're absolutely right. There's a big assumption there. The scale separation and the you know C0 is a big assumption. And we don't know anything about the nonlinear problem itself, which one would like to attack. Problem recovering the sound speed itself, I mean the background. This is more propaganda about macrolocal analysis than anything else. It can be useful, you know, I hope it can be useful in practical application.
Could you realistically invert data to get 21 elastic constants?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. You have to have, you know. But you know you have many experiments,
right,
to do away from the double characteristic point. So you have to set up 21 experiments, different experiments, to be able to recover. In principle, theoretically, you can prove you can do it. In practice, I don't know. I mean, for a transversely isotropic case, when you have 5, seems to be possible.
Any other questions or comments? Well, not Gunther. We do appreciate coming here, taking the time to prepare your talk.
Yes,
and away from, I'm sure, other things. And in addition to your expenses that we're going to cover, or rather, PIMS is going to cover.
Thank you.
We'd like to give you a little gift.
Okay.
It's an official mug from the Institute of Applied Mathematics.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, okay. Thanks a lot. I can have Seattle best coffee or Starbucks coffee in this one.
Not me, that's a good one.